Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. I'm almost on vacation.
Almost on vacation. Yeah, so you're not going to be here next week.
I won't.
So we're going to have we'll have Ray on again, so we're going to get a double dose of Ray. But you're here this week to talk to us.
I'm here.
And we have plenty of stuff to get to. We have an interview with Dr. Karen Berg, who is a candidate for Senate in District 26th in Jefferson and Oldham counties, and that will be at the back of the show. Before that, we have a gubernatorial update. We have stories about Allison Lonergan Grimes. Jasmine's going to tell us a little bit about legislative travel. And I have a JCPS board story. And we have a story about the LRC. So tons of stuff to get to. Lots of news. Without any further ado, let's get to the JCPS board settlement. Okay, before we get started, Jasmine, we're equal partners on this show. We both do a lot of work. But, you know, you've been busy this week.
Yeah, you did more work than me.
So this is going to be a lot of me. So if you hate that, I'm sorry, but there's been a lot of news. We have to get to it. And,
some fans have said that it's too much you.
Well, those people are probably right. All right. But we're going to talk about the JCPS board this week. Okay. So Jasmine, late on Monday night, which was August 27th, the JCPS school board voted 4-3 to accept a settlement from interim commissioner Wayne Lewis and the Kentucky State Board of Education. So we've talked about this at length. There was a takeover attempt. There was a settlement offered. They went back and forth. There were deadlines that were missed. Things were happening. Negotiations were happening. On Monday night, the JCPS school board, they took the settlement. The deal allows for JCPS to retain its authority in most matters and will continue as a policymaking body. And that's nice because under a takeover, the JCPS school board would have only existed in an advisory capacity. The deal allows for the Kentucky Board of Education to have, quote, final approval over the issues of special education, physical restraint and seclusion, and early childhood education. That means that JCPS retains policymaking authority, but that the KBOE essentially has the power to veto any changes in these areas. So the KBOE, they cannot make policy. They cannot, like, suggest and put things into place around these issues, which would have been the case under a takeover. So JCPS has to come up with a policy. And
they have veto power,
yeah,
basically.
They essentially have veto power. In addition to the items where the KBOE has veto power, JCPS is required to notify KBOE of changes to policy around career and technical education and facility maintenance and replacement. So those were other big issues in the audit. So they don't have veto.
It's just they have to tell them
about
it.
Yeah, they have to let them know what's going on. The vaguest piece of the agreement is about the student assignment plan.
Oh.
Right. So point 11 of the settlement says that KBOE understands that JCPS is reviewing the student assignment plan and that the JCPS is going to modify it before the 2020-2021 year, which would be in the next gubernatorial term, just by the way, that could come into play here. To me, the vagueness of this section makes it clear that most of the negotiations were around this point, which is what we expected.
So JCPS is going to modify it, but how the understands part is weird. Mm-hmm. I don't really get it.
Yeah, there isn't anything to get. There's not. Okay. It's very vague. it's basically
not just me.
Yeah. So basically, they just say JCPS is going to modify the SAP before 2020 and 2021, but there was no like punishment laid out if they didn't.
Right.
Yeah. They don't have that notification piece. They don't have the veto piece. Kentucky Board of Education has no real authority over the student assignment plan in JCPS, except for that they can then essentially take the school district over if they want to anyway. So
sure.
Yeah, which is not changed in any of this. Okay, so the agreement also mandates another audit of JCPS in 2020, which either would clear the district or make JCPS a, quote, state-assisted district or make JCPS a, quote, state-managed district. So in 2020, we have a chance to do this all over again.
Okay, that's what I was guessing that we were getting to with
right.
The whole modification of the student assignment plan. So state-managed would mean taken over.
Mm-hmm.
State assisted is more like what we're doing
right
now.
Now, they did also make clear that all of the appeals processes still are in place after that as well. So we literally would be back to square one if Kentucky Board of Education does anything besides say you're in the clear now. So if they make the decision to make it state managed or state assisted, we would go through the appeals process. We would have the administrative court. They probably would try to do a negotiated settlement again or whatever. But yeah, in 2020, we're likely going to do this dance one more time. The three JCPS school board members who voted against the agreement were Chris Kolb, Lisa Wilner, and Chris Brady. Mr. Kolb was quoted by the Courier Journal. I think he might be Dr. Kolb. No, he teaches at Spalding. Chris Kolb was quoted by the Courier Journal as saying that the agreement was, quote, not terrible, unquote, but that he voted against it because of loopholes that allowed the state to take over the district. Kolb also seemed confident that JCPS would have won in court if the appeal had gotten that far. He also wrote a special to the Courier Journal basically saying, you know, we shouldn't have done this.
Those were probably the three that I would have guessed.
Yeah, me
that
too.
Voted against it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a little surprised, you know, other people voted for it, to be honest with you. Like Steph Horn, I was a little surprised by that one.
So you thought that it may have failed?
I was surprised that it came through. We'll get into that in a second. So school superintendent Marty Polio, he supported the settlement while acknowledging the difficulty of the decision. So basically, I think that people were voting. This in many ways was a vote of trust in Marty Polio more than anything else. Marty Polio said, this is the best deal that we're going to be able to get, and I don't want to go through the appeals process, I think is basically the way that the decision came down. So basically, Jasmine, I'm going to sum up the entire situation for us. Governor Bevin executed a total takeover of the State Board of Education, who then fired the Education Commissioner, installed a man who had deep ties to the charter school movement. This man then immediately began a takeover of the state's largest school district, and at the end of that process, the takeover didn't happen, but he retained significant power over the district's policies. So basically, that's what we've seen, a huge influx of influence by Governor Bevin and the Bevin administration people over JCPS at the end of the day. We've been through a lot, but that's where we're sitting. However, the audit of JCPS did reveal significant problems with the district, especially around student safety. We've talked about this at length. There was some bad stuff in
there. And I'm glad that that did come to light. I don't like what it's come to. But I've been like screaming for a couple years about like the use of restraints and things like that.
And JCPS was not reactive to that. Like there were people that were calling this to the carpet and they weren't that reactive and the state stepped in and kind of did. Now, there were other steps that were taken as well after the audit was announced. But, you know, that's where we're at. So some sort of state intervention was probably necessary around those issues. Maybe not a takeover, maybe not to reduce the authority of the JCPS school board, especially not by the Bevin administration, but something needed to happen. Something needed to happen, which is, I think, what you're saying. And Jasmine, we said all along that a deal centered around these items and which excluded the state from the student assignment plan would be preferable to one that centered around things like the student assignment plan and JCPS's more progressive racial policies. That's, at the end of the day, close to what we have.
Right.
Yeah. So, Jasmine, hanging over this whole issue to me is a gamble. JCPS could have continued to fight the takeover. They could have taken the deal to Frankfurt through the administrative hearing where they definitely would have lost, and then to court where they might have won. They could also have tried to run out the clock. If Governor Bevin loses the election next year, a Democratic governor could again fully replace the school board and nix the takeover. But if they had lost, Wayne Lewis and the KBOE would have had even more power than he does now. So there's lots of ways for that to have gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
This is clearly not a gamble that Marty Polio and a majority of the JCPS school board wanted to take.
So this is exactly what I do on a daily basis.
Well, there you go.
So someone that's charged with a crime, they could take their case to trial, but it's a huge gamble. There's a chance they could get found guilty. There's a chance they could get a worse sentence than they're being offered. Or they have a settlement that's maybe kind of crappy, but sometimes it's better in the end. And it's a crappy position to be in, but JCPS was in that position.
Right.
And a lot of times people do choose to take the settlement.
Right. And sometimes they just choose to go to court. And I don't think anybody on the JCPS school board really thinks that they want any of this settlement to have happened. I just think that they prefer it to the risk of getting taken over.
Exactly.
So I think that's where we're at with that. Okay, Jasmine, another story. This has been all over the news the past couple of days. There are more problems for Allison Lunderkin Grimes in the Kentucky Board of Elections. So we had the Board of Education, now we have the Board of Elections. So Jasmine, back in November, we did a story about the then Assistant Executive Director of the State Board of Education, whose name is Matthew Self. Mr. Self filed a complaint against Allison Lunderkin Grimes, who was then, and this guy, Mr. Self, was then fired along with the State Board of Elections Executive Director. We talked about that when it went on. Do you remember this?
Yep. It was a little while ago.
Yeah, it was pretty wild, though, like the person getting fired. So now the new Executive Director of the State Board of Education, whose name is Jared Deering, he is also accusing Allison Lunderkin Grimes of impropriety. So the charges made by Deering are different than Mr. Self, but Daniel DeRochers of the Herald Leader in his write-up said that both of their complaints are rooted in Grimes having inappropriate access to the state's voter registration system. Self's charges last year stemmed from Grimes only paying the $450 fee for access to the voter database once, even though she ran for office twice. He also charged that Grimes took data from the database on a thumb drive without proper documentation or purpose. So that was Self from last year. Deering's accusations this year center around Grimes' alleged noncompliance with a settlement with Judicial Watch. Jasmine, are you familiar with Judicial Watch?
No.
Okay, they are a very conservative judicial group that works with conservative causes in the judicial system. So this is a big issue for them, is basically like voter rolls and kicking people off of voter rolls. So that was what this was. The settlement by Judicial Watch in Kentucky required that Kentucky clean up its voter rolls by basically kicking everybody off of the voter rolls, deregistering people who hadn't voted in 6 consecutive elections. So the State of Board of Elections decided to do that by sending out 600,000 postcards to confirm the voters who hadn't voted in 6 elections in 48 counties. And according to Deering, Grimes ordered him to slow walk that process. So just really quickly, 48 counties had more people registered to vote than they did population, voting age population. And Judicial Watch sued and said that was inappropriate, that the voter rolls were wrong. A settlement was reached to say they would try to kick off people who hadn't voted in more than 6 elections because they were dead or moved or whatever. Process was started, and Deering is saying that Grimes ordered him to slow walk that process. Deering also alleged that Grimes used the database to look up voting records of election board staffers and job candidates. Obviously, the database doesn't say who you voted for, but it says whether or not you voted. And Deering also claimed that Grimes created a hostile work environment and claims that Grimes contacted his family members and said that he was not being sufficiently loyal to her. So that's not great.
No,
that's not great. So Jasmine, then on Tuesday morning, the Kentucky GOP called for a federal investigation into Alice Lonergan Grimes. So this all broke on Monday. On Tuesday, GOP is calling for a federal investigation. That's not really all that surprising, I guess, since they're a political arm, and whenever the other party's getting in a scandal, you're calling for more and more investigations. But I think it actually might happen, since the Kentucky GOP has some pretty big friends in the federal government, including, you know, the president and the majority leader. So a special meeting of the State Board of Elections was held that same Tuesday, August 28th. There were some shenanigans about open records. Basically, you have to wait 24 hours before you can have a meeting that's like legal and that you can actually go into executive session in. So basically, in order to be clear of the open records law, everybody had to sit next to each other for 45 minutes without speaking. So that's kind of weird. And then the meeting actually happened and immediately went into executive session. So they emerged several hours later and nothing had changed. Everybody was kind of thinking that Mr. Deering was going to lose his job, even Mr. Deering. He did not lose his job. He stood by his letter. He did not recant his letter. He didn't say anything about his letter. He just said he stood by it and he was not fired. So status quo after this meeting.
Right. Okay.
So Alison Lonergan Grimes then took questions from the media. She said that she vigorously disputes the allegations in Mr. Deering's letter while admitting to calling a member of his family, because she said she's friends with this person. She's like, I'm just calling my friend who happens to be in his family and saying, I mean, that would be like me calling, well, you don't have any siblings. It'd be like you calling my sister and being like, Robert's doing too many stories on the podcast today. That would be like, that's what she said it was like. She did say there was disagreement about eliminating people who haven't voted in more than 6 years from voter rolls. Personally, I think that you probably shouldn't do that. I think people need every opportunity to vote, and if they've ever registered, they need to be able to vote, and kicking people off voter rolls is not a good idea. But then she also said that accusations started to arrive about her once she refused to cooperate with the Trump Election Fraud Commission, if you remember that. That was
right, and that's probably around the time that a lot of this did happen.
Yes.
Or come about.
Absolutely. So, Jasmine, this is a really confusing story, in my opinion. There's some serious accusations in Mr. Deering's letter about a compliance with a lawsuit, right? That's not great. If you have a settlement and you're not complying with it, that's bad. But then also some scary stuff about Grimes' role as a leader. However, in my mind, Mr. Deering and Mr. Self before him have had trouble connecting those two things. So you have, like, on one hand, the inability to, like, you know, Deering has like the slow walking, right? Which is, that's a clear violation of the law. And Mr. Self, he had like this illegal accessing of this database, which would be a crime. But at the same time, they've both brought up this, like, Alison Lundgren Grimes is a bad person. She has created this hostile work environment. She's trying to fire everybody. In my mind, you know, those are almost two separate things. And it's been kind of difficult for me to connect those two, each of those two things inside of the story.
Sure.
So there's no doubt that Alison Lundgren Grimes has had a pretty good couple of months up until now. We talked about her after Fancy Farm and said she did a really good job. And politically, her star is kind of on the rise again. I don't think personally it's beyond her opponents in either party to try to take her down a few notches. I don't know if that's what's going on here, but I don't think that would be weird if
yeah.
that were the case.
And the first story with Mr. Self, that one was pretty quiet. I mean, that was like a small story that we did on here, but it didn't get a lot of momentum. I saw all kinds of stuff online about this one. So
yeah.
this one, it's getting bigger. What do you think about how that could affect her and her potential governor run? Do you think it's big deal, medium deal?
Well, here's what I do think about that. At the end of the day, I think the resolution here seemed to be pretty above board, right? Unlike Mr. Self, who was fired for basically like firing an ethics complaint, which is not great.
Mm-hmm.
With Mr. Deering here, he's standing by his letter. He's going to be able to file that with the Executive Branch Ethics Commission, and he gets to keep his job. So basically, like, this is kind of like what you want to have happen in these sorts of things. They're being allowed to play out, and he's being allowed to do his work, and Alison Lundgren Grimes is sitting there and doing her work. I did think it looked like he was headed towards getting fired like Mr. Self. But like you said, the media pressure was bigger on this one, and I think it kept it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe this is a story more than anything about how the media makes our elected officials do better work.
the watchdog.
Yeah, the watchdog role in the media. But basically for her, I think that if they bring Mr. Self up, she doesn't have a good excuse. This guy tried to take you down, you fired him. The second guy, this is a little bit more appropriate. This guy has brought these things to your attention. And you say, okay, we sent it to the independent groups. They're reviewing it. If there's a problem, they can have it. You know what it feels like, Jasmine?
What?
Hillary Clinton.
Ah.
Yeah. It feels a little bit like that. Like, what's going on? There's a lot of smoke going on here. Is there a fire? And the people who don't like Alison Lundgren Grimes are going to be like, absolutely, she's super corrupt, as you can see. That's been going on in her family for dozens of years. But, you know, who knows? You're not able to see the fire. So There you go. Jasmine, do your story about legislative travel.
All right. So last week, Joe Sonka of Insider Louisville and a former podcast guest wrote a piece about a loophole in state ethics law, and it has to do with legislators' travel expenditures. So Insider Louisville estimated that in 2017, outside groups had about $100,000 tab for conferences and events for state legislators.
That's impressive.
But it's really hard to estimate because these expenditures many of them never had to be reported to LRC or the Kentucky Legislative Ethics Commission because of this loophole in reporting laws. So the current law does not require disclosure for prepaid transportation, food, or lodging. So if a private group pays for someone and they prepay for the trip, no disclosure.
That is what we call a loophole.
Yeah. Big loophole. But most travel is still publicly funded. So close to 2/3 of the state legislators reported a total of 200 out-of-state trips that totaled $290,000. The other third didn't report any travel. 60% of the publicly funded trips were for basically like the two big policy conferences, the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Southern Legislative Conference. So that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Those are the two big ones.
You want
right?
your legislators going to
right.
that. They really do make legislators better at their jobs.
But the trip that ranked third for use of public funds was the ALEC Annual Summit. So that is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And I'm sure you've probably heard the acronym before. They are a group of conservative state legislators and private sector representatives that seek to create model conservative legislation like deregulation bills, strict immigration policy, that kind of stuff. Several Republicans attended that summit, but three Democrats also attended that on taxpayer money, which were Representative Steve Riggs, Senator Gerald Neal, and Senator Dorsey Ridley.
Interesting.
And I think Dorsey Ridley like made a comment that they were going to see what the opposition had coming, mm-hmm. you know, something like that.
Yeah.
This isn't the first time we've talked about legislator travel. A few months ago, we talked about Senator Damon Thayer's trip to London. So a photo of him in London was recognized, and he was among legislators from six other states. So that was paid for by the GOPAC Education Fund's Institute for Leadership Development. So that's a group that seeks to get Republicans elected. Corporate sponsors allegedly paid GOPAC to send their lobbyists on the trip with the legislators. And the corporations that did that weren't publicly reported.
Which is what you said, like, that's the loophole, right?
Right.
Right.
Senator Thayer confirmed that he was there. He said that GOPAC paid for it, but that he wasn't lobbied by anyone and that no taxpayer dollars were spent. So no big deal, right?
Uh-huh, right, yeah, sure.
But other legislators also took trips funded by GOPAC to Santa Barbara, Austin, and Indianapolis. And the Insider Louisville article, I encourage people to read it because it goes in depth about where different legislators took trips and who paid for them. But we have a long show today, and I think that that's, I don't want to regurgitate that whole article, but it is really interesting. The Kentucky Legislative Ethics Commission wants to close the loophole. So mm-hmm. they want the General Assembly to amend the law to require all approved out-of-state travel information in their financial disclosures. Some legislators would argue that they're saving the state money by traveling on private dimes, right? But the argument against it is that taxpayers may be hurt indirectly by policies that may be coming law as a result of these summits, conferences, all of this travel.
Right.
And obviously, the bigger issue is a transparency issue.
Right.
Some legislators may be enjoying going on these big vacations that are paid for out-of-state groups. There were comments in the article about some legislators just like to be wined and dined.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have absolutely no idea what's going on these trips because they're not disclosed or reported. So, you know, Senator Thayer said, basically, why does anyone care? The taxpayers didn't pay anything for it. But it's a transparency thing. It's an accountability thing. And hopefully the Ethics Commission passed a unanimous resolution asking the General Assembly in the next session to amend this law to close this loophole. Yeah. But there we go.
Yeah, if we have divided government next year, I think that this will absolutely be like HB1 or something from a Democratic House if that happens. And mm-hmm. then, you know, what the Senate does with it will be something that's highly politicized. And yeah, I think that, you know, for good reason. I mean, I think Damon Thayer should just be like, guys, I'm really conservative. I'm not going to change my opinion on anything. I'm just going to take the Republican line on whatever they give me. So that's a different way to talk.
Twitter blocker in chief.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Jasmine, let's talk a little bit about the LRC, a sad, sad story about the LRC. So on Tuesday, August 28th, the LRC director, David Byerman, he released a statement indicating that his contract with the state would not be renewed after it expired at the end of September. Director Byerman came to Kentucky from Nevada and took over from Robert Sherman, who had led the LRC into several scandals involving sexual harassment, which was not good. Director Byerman stated in his letter that the Senate president and the speaker pro tem wanted to take the director position, quote, in a different direction.
It's what they always say.
In a hint as to what that actually means, Director Byerman's duties in the interim will be performed by the chiefs of staff for the Republican caucuses in both houses of the legislature. Which, that's pretty crazy. So some reminders, the Legislative Research Commission is the organization that staffs the legislature.
And they're super important.
Very, so important. The vast majority of the LRC, and this is the important part, are nonpartisan workers. So 325 out of the 372 people that work there. And those people analyze bills and provide neutral information about the impact of proposed legislation. Another set of workers at the LRC are partisan staff who work directly for legislatures. And a lot of the big scandals about, you know, different sorts of unqualified people working there typically are partisan staff. We had Charles Booker on our show recently. He talked about being fired from the LRC for appearing in the background of an Allers and Lundgren Grimes ad. So, you know, they take their nonpartisanship very seriously. Mm-hmm. So it's long been the idea to split the LRC into two organizations, one which performs the partisan tasks and one which performs the nonpartisan tasks. We don't really know what the GOP has in store here, but context clues seem to indicate this might be where we are headed next. And, you know, honestly, there's ways that you could do that it wouldn't be a bad idea. But having any sort of partisan control over the leadership of the LRC, as is the case right now, or will be at the end of September, is not good. That's very, very bad. And regardless of anything else, this is a tragedy. I have worked personally with Director Byerman, asking him for all kinds of data. I'm an annoying person when it comes to that sort of thing. And he's never been anything besides incredibly professional and helpful to me, just from a personal standpoint. And you know, I also know other Republican people who are more conservative, just so you know, it's not just he's trying to help me out because I'm a Democrat or whatever. People who are more conservative also said he was very good at his job and acted very professionally in everything that he did. I certainly hope that the next person Kentucky hires is of the same ilk as him, a nonpartisan person who provides good neutral information and good data. But honestly, Jasmine, I'm not really holding out much hope. So
it's not looking good.
It's not looking good. Okay, now we've got a lot to get to still, but there's one other story I did want to talk about, and that's just a quick gubernatorial update. Jasmine, can you believe the last story that we're going to talk about before the interview is the Kentucky governor's race, where Matt Bevin declared his candidacy on Saturday. So he is running for re-election. Are you surprised?
Not really.
You're not. Yeah, I'm not really either. Governor Bevin made his announcement at the GOP Lincoln Day dinner, which is the corollary to the Democratic Wendell Ford dinner. This year, the dinner's keynote speaker was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but Governor Bevin was the final speaker of the evening. At the end of his speech, so like the very end of the event, he said, quote, "There's one matter I want to clear up. You bet I'm running again," unquote. Media were on hand during the speech and were able to quickly gauge Republican reaction. Senate President Robert Stivers was quoted in the Courier-Journal article by Philip Bailey and Tom Loftus, and Stivers said that he fully expected Governor Bevin to run again, but that it was a surprise to hear it on Saturday. Stivers also said that he doesn't expect Bevin to face any Republican opposition.
What about C. Wesley Morgan? Someone like that.
I thought, yeah, he's on your team, right? The gubernatorial draft. I got Matt Bevin. Yeah. So, yeah. Jasmine, it may be true that Governor Bevin won't face any Republican opposition. Governor Bevin has been very elusive about his declaring his candidacy, though, and so several people have speculated about other Republican candidates. Names floated included Hal Heiner, Jamie Comer, and Brett Guthrie. Guthrie and Comer are both closer to Mitch McConnell than to the Republican establishment in Kentucky, so like Robert Stivers and, you know, David Osborne and such. And it will be very interesting to see if they do indeed demur on running. If the JCPS takeover ends up fizzling out, which, you know, I wrote this before that happened. if something happens with that would make it so that Hal Heiner has less to do, he may jump in. So I don't know. I'll be honest, Jasmine. I was hoping that Governor Bevin would run for re-election. I was hoping that he would run. He seems pretty weak. And especially Eastern Kentucky has seemed to turn on him since the 2018 session where he was very anti-teacher.
Right.
However, now that he's running, I'm remembering that he was a really good retail candidate. They made a big story about how he was driving around the state in his Toyota, and he'll probably do that again. he has a record that will be very difficult to defend. I think that will be very tough. But he did manage to hold Mitch McConnell to 60% in a GOP primary. He beat Hal Heiner and Jamie Comer in a gubernatorial primary, and then he crushed Jack Conway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's a good politician. There's no denying it.
I think in that primary, he did a great job of Hal Heiner and Jamie Comer were kind of pitted against each other. And Matt Bevin's like the other guy out there and did a really great job.
He's gotten really lucky. He got really lucky with that gubernatorial primary. There's no doubt about it. But the Mitch McConnell primary, I think, is the one that's more impressive. Mitch McConnell is a known quantity in Kentucky. He's won many of his elections, especially the generals, really closely. But he held Mitch McConnell to 60% in a Republican primary, which I think that of all of his races, is the one that speaks best about him.
And that was his very first one, too.
Yeah. So, Jasmine, after announcing his candidacy, he gave some quotes to Philip Bailey of the Courier-Journal saying, quote, "What would be more fun than to watch a primary with Lil Andy, Allison Grimes, Rocky, and Atticus Scott? I mean, seriously, would that not be fun? It would be fun for a change to watch them ripping each other up and to see who would emerge from such a thing," unquote. So Speaking of Democrats ripping each other up, in gubernatorial primary news this week, Representative Rocky Adkins called on Andy Beshear to stop raising money for his campaign before the 2018 election. So here's a quote. Quote, "The money that's being raised by any candidate for next year's election, in my opinion, needs to stop, and it needs to cease now. It is of utmost importance that we have every able body, including Andy Beshear and anybody else out there who may be looking in 2019, to not be drying up the money for our candidates across the state," unquote.
And this is something we talked about. Many potential candidates at Fancy Farm said things like this, that they wish Andy Beshear had waited till the November elections. And Rocky Adkins has been saying this for a little while now.
Yeah. So Andy Beshear's campaign cited its help of other candidates across the state. And their campaign is indeed doing that. Jasmine, in this very space where we record the podcast, I ran into Jacqueline Coleman for a legislative fundraiser. So, you know, I saw her, I met her, said hello. So the Beshear campaign is indeed doing this thing that they say. They are helping legislative candidates raise money. The main reason to get into the race early, like Andy Beshear did, is to raise money before anybody else and to try to scale up the competition. So Rocky Adkins is keenly turning that tactic against Andy Beshear. So if Andy Beshear does manage to raise a lot of money, he looks like a jerk. But if he doesn't raise any money, he also looks like an idiot. So, you know, this is a deft political move by Rocky Adkins. And Andy Beshear really did not get in early. We're saying getting in early because these other people haven't gotten in. But by this time, Jack Conway was running for governor. Steve Beshear was running for governor. There were tons of people.
Right, this is about the time that people get in.
In the past, lots of people have gotten in before the midterm elections. So the next reporting deadline is September 30th. So at that time, we will certainly look to see how Andy Beshear's number is looking and what the reaction is to it. Whew. Jasmine, those are all the stories. Let's now listen to our interview with Dr. Karen Berg.
Dr. Karen Berg is the candidate for the Kentucky Senate in District 26 in Jefferson and Oldham counties. She is a practicing diagnostic radiologist, making her first run for political office. Dr. Berg's opponent in her race is incumbent Senator Ernie Harris, who's served the district since 1995. District 26 covers all of Oldham County and the northeastern part of Jefferson County, mostly along the river, also covering parts of St. Matthews and the Crescent Hill neighborhood. Dr. Berg, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Well, thank you. Very excited to be here.
Okay, so like many of the candidates we've interviewed for this podcast, you are a female candidate running for office for the first time in 2018. So just to start, tell us why you decided on this year to make your first run for elected office.
Well, it's a bit of a long story. I originally, before I ever went to medical school, I studied political science at the University of Kentucky. I was pre-law. I was going to work for legal aid, run for office, and try to change the world. I was dissuaded, ended up going to medical school, and I've loved practicing medicine. But about 3 years ago, started feeling that people who are running for office and are elected politicians were working more towards their own self-interests. Mm-hmm. And I felt honestly working to try to divide people and not bring them together. So the thought of, you know, we need good people to stand up and run for office, I discussed it with my family. It was my youngest child, Henry, who suggested that if I was really interested, I should apply to Emerge. Emerge is a national program, takes Democratic women, teaches us how to run, it teaches us how to win. So I had applied for Emerge before the 2016 election. And when you apply, you actually agree that you're going to run mm-hmm. within 5 years. But it was the 2016 election that made me realize that now is the time. Mm-hmm. Good people have to stand up. Those of us who are able, those of us who are willing, have to stand up, put ourselves out, run for office, get elected, and try to serve the common good. I am doing this honestly because I care about people and because I'm willing and able to put myself out for public service at this point.
So you worked as a physician, but you know, you've made it clear now and on the campaign trail that politics and government has always been a big passion of yours. We're curious about how, for you, your work in medicine and your passion for government mix. Will healthcare be a defining issue for you in Frankfort, do you think?
I think healthcare will be an important issue for me. I'm really excited about being able to get to Frankfurt and share some of the knowledge that I've been able to gain over the last 30 years working not only, you know, at University Hospital and in the more public sector, mm-hmm. but also at several of the private hospitals in the city. And I've also was medical director of diagnostic radiology at the Veterans Hospital for 6 years. So I have experience in a lot of different facets of healthcare delivery and management. Whether healthcare will be a defining issue is sort of difficult for me. I mean, there's many, many things I care about. Okay. One, you know, is public education. Mm-hmm. I think public education is the absolute bedrock of our society. I think it is the great equalizer, and I think it is what basically fosters the American dream. Mm-hmm. And without good quality publication, without supporting public education in this state, both on a primary, secondary, and post-secondary level, I don't think there's any way that Kentucky is going to be able to compete nationally. So that's something I care about tremendously as well.
Absolutely. So out of Kentucky's 120 counties, only about 30 have more than 50% of their voters that are registered as Republicans. So it's not a very big group, but Oldham County is one of those counties. And really only 10 counties in Kentucky have more total registered Republicans than Oldham County. Now, your district is a big chunk. The whole of Oldham County is in your district. Across the country, though, suburban counties like Oldham have been swinging towards Democrats. So to start, do you think that Oldham County voters are going to be part of this trend that we're seeing nationally?
I have absolutely no doubt. I mean, we have knocked over 13,000 doors at this point. So I have had the opportunity to talk to voters at the doors for months. And people are looking for somebody that they can trust. Mm-hmm. Somebody that is not going to further create, you know, for want of better words, havoc and division in our society. Mm-hmm. And not just the women. I mean, you know, historically or across the country since the 2016 election, it's been primarily women that are willing to vote across party lines for somebody that they believe in and somebody they trust. My experience has not just been the women. People are upset. Mm-hmm. People are afraid. I can tell you guys, I have people at the doors literally crying. Mm-hmm. They are crying. They want this madness to end.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy out there for sure. So the last time that Kentucky redrew legislative districts, the Republican-led Senate, they drew the Senate map. And, you know, the Democrats, they redrew the House map. And so as a part of that, Jefferson County is actually split among 10 different Senate districts. And five of those districts are represented by Republicans. So of the 10 Senate districts that have some part that's in Jefferson County, half of those are represented by Republicans. So you do have a big chunk of Jefferson County voters in addition to your Oldham County vote. And given that, you know, you kind of have two options to defeat this gerrymander. And you know, they're not exactly opposed to one another, but there's two kind of ways you can go about this. So you can make a big push for big turnout in Jefferson County, or you can really do some work to get the Oldham County voters to switch the way that they would vote. And, you know, obviously you're going to do both of those things. But besides that, which do you think are you going to spend more of your time working towards?
Well, the answer to that, in the primary, mm-hmm. we knew we had enough registered Democratic voters in Jefferson County mm-hmm. to win the primary.
Right.
So obviously our focus in the primary was predominantly, not exclusively by any means, we knocked multiple precincts in Oldham County as well, but predominantly Jefferson County, because we knew that's where mm-hmm. that we could get the votes from there. For the general, you know, I have two things basically in mind. One is to get out to Oldham County, where my opponent is better known, mm-hmm. make sure people know who I am, know why I'm running, know what I care about. But not forget that I have a strong Democratic base in Jefferson County. Mm-hmm. So I don't want those people to feel ignored.
Right.
I mean, my goal, honestly, is to do all of it.
Right. That's a good goal. And we hope we accomplish it. So you've been endorsed by CFAIR, which is the political committee for the Fairness Campaign, and also for Moms Demand Action, which is a gun control group. So you proudly display those endorsements right on the front of your website. When talking about your race, I've talked to some political professionals that say, you know, you're too far to the left to win in Oldham County. And they cite those specific endorsements as a reason for that. However, when I look at it, gun control and LGBTQ issues are the types of issues that have specific appeal in suburban counties like Oldham. So what do you say to people who say that you're too far to the left for Oldham County?
Well, just an illustrative answer. I was doing some volunteer work at Fairness during the primary election, setting up for their annual event in Frankfurt. And they have registration cards that they collect for the entire year from all over the state. And they're given to their representatives at that day in Frankfurt. And our job was to sort these registration cards out. District 19, which is Morgan McGarvey's district, had the highest stack of cards on the table. District 26, which is my district, was number two.
Wow.
In the state.
Wow, that's amazing.
So to say this is not an issue that people in Oldham County and northeastern Jefferson County care about is wrong. I will tell you that they are represented by somebody who does not respect them, will not even, in many cases, talk to them and meet them. So I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a practicing physician. I am fiscally extremely conservative. I do not believe in spending money that we don't know we need to spend it. We don't know it's going to do what we need it to do. But to say supporting LGBTQ rights is too far left, I mean, I was taught, honestly, I was taught you love your neighbor. You don't judge your neighbor and then decide if they're worthy of your love or not.
Right, right.
So I don't think it's far left at all. As far as common sense gun legislation, I mean, guys, I've worked at university for over 30 years. I've been on the receiving side of this. I've gotten text messages that my kid's school is on lockdown up in D.C. I've had parents in Oldham County walk up to me, fathers with tears in their eyes, and say, please do whatever you can to make my kids safe at school. That's not a far left message. That's a very centrist message. We need people to pay attention to what our constituents want.
So let's talk a little bit about your opponent. So your opponent, Ernie Harris, he faced a really stiff primary challenge from Alex White. So he only won his primary by a few more than 400 votes. What did the Republican primary tell you about his vulnerability? And did you learn anything from Alex White's campaign?
What the Republican primary showed me was multiple things. One, we had more Democrats get out in our Democratic primary, then Republicans showed up in the Republican primary, which what is historically a Republican district, okay?
And a tight election for the Republicans.
A very tight election for the Republicans. There is momentum. People want positive change. People are realizing the impact of not getting out and voting and what that actually means when it comes to post-primary and who's in charge, or post-general and who's in charge, excuse me. So what it means to me is that the incumbent, who's been there for 23 years, doesn't have the strong support of his constituents. This is a 29-year-old personal injury lawyer with no political background whatsoever. He was almost able to beat him in his Republican primary. The numbers look really positive to me.
It's tough to argue with that. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that. Jasmine wasn't here, but the fill-in we had, she cited your race as one that she was absolutely watching based on the numbers that she'd seen. So
well, and the other thing, on the Jefferson County side of the district, District 26 had the highest turnout on the Democratic side of any district in the state.
Wow.
We were really able to energize voters, and we'd worked hard at it. I mean, we knocked, you know, over 5,000 doors in that primary, 2,000 additional doors in GOTV. We have a message. It's a strong message. It's a cohesive message. It's a message of let's be reasonable with each other. Let's respect each other. Let's talk to each other and try to work together.
Absolutely. So we think fiscal issues are really serious here on My Old Kentucky Podcast. And we've been asking all of our candidates specifically about House Bill 29. And House Bill 29 is a tax reform bill that's been sponsored by Jim Wayne and many other House Democrats last year and for several years in the past. So first of all, do you support the reforms in this bill? And then would you vote to pass it in a future session?
Okay. I was always taught, teach thy tongue to say, I do not know, and thou shalt progress. So I don't want to overspeak my boundaries here. Mm-hmm. I have read the bill. I have talked to not Jim Wayne himself, but some of the other co-sponsors on the bill. Mm-hmm. It looks to me to be a very good, cohesive piece of legislation. I know Jim Wayne personally and by reputation, and he has a reputation of being very thorough, mm-hmm. very meticulous. I strongly suspect that with more knowledge, mm-hmm. this is a bill that I would have been happy mm-hmm. to vote for.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, yeah, and by the time it gets to the Senate, there will obviously be changes made to it and everything. So you'll have a decision to make then if it makes it out of the House. So you'll have that to worry about in the first place. So for sure.
We definitely need to reform our taxes. I mean, it's old, it's antiquated. We need forward-thinking, progressive tax structure that's not regressive, because we have to consider the revenue side for the state as well.
Mm-hmm. And one other question, just kind of about your role in the Senate. So you're running for a Senate seat, and in Kentucky, the Senate's been in control of the Republicans since 2000. And people in the House, a lot of them are running with thinking about retaining a majority. And not to say that's out of reach in the Senate, but Democrats have been in the minority in the Senate for a long time. So tell us a little bit how you expect to be effective as a legislator and what is likely to be a minority caucus in the next time that you're, or if you're elected in the fall.
That's a good question. And I've asked that question at the doors. My answer is, even if I am not in the majority, it does not mean that I do not have a voice mm-hmm. and a strong, steady, reasoned voice. If the Democrats, and hopefully they will be, are successful in bringing back the House in 2018, and we can pick up several seats in the Senate mm-hmm. in 2018, by 2020, we have a strong possibility of actually possibly taking back the majority.
Wow.
And I don't work, in the short term. I work more in the long term. I am a long-term planner. I'm slow and steady wins the race. And like I say, I will still have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, I think that's it's an optimistic take, but I don't think it's one that's unmerited. And I think that, Democrats are certainly on the upswing. And, if we could take back the Senate, that would be huge. That would be great.
So you talked about public education and we talked about healthcare. What are some other issues that are important to you, the first bills that you would plan to file if you're elected?
First bills. Things that I care personally tremendously about. Common sense gun legislation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about, I know we have a Second Amendment.
Right.
I know people have the right to bear arms. But as a society, we also have a right to make sure that we're protected. Mm-hmm. So some really basic common sense legislation, like we need people to be licensed and registered mm-hmm. so that if you're convicted, if you're a domestic abuser and you are convicted, there's a law that says we have a right to take your guns away because we know those people are at high risk of hurting people with them. Mm-hmm. We don't have a way of knowing that you have a gun mm-hmm. or how many guns you have to take that gun away. So basic licensing, registration, being able to take guns out of domestic abusers' homes. I personally think that assault weapons should not be for sale in our sporting goods stores. I care tremendously about fairness. I think that the fact that people in this state, and so many people at the doors don't even know that this exists, but with the exceptions of the cities that have passed their own fairness ordinances, mm-hmm. the vast majority of places in the state, you can get fired and kicked out of your home if your employer or landlord finds out that you're gay. Mm-hmm. I think that's not fair to people, for one. Mm-hmm. I also think it puts us behind other states as far as our ability to attract businesses to this state.
Absolutely.
Because nobody wants to relocate their workers to a state where they're not going to feel safe and secure and wanted. I have, you know, family members that have been personally very severely affected by the opioid crisis. And as a physician, I see this as, the word iatrogenic is a big word. It's a man-made or hospital-made crisis. I remember personally, very clearly, being required to attend continuing medical education courses back in the early 90s, where I was being told it was malpractice not to treat people's pain, that we had good drugs that were not addicting, that we needed to be using. Mm-hmm. And I sat there, I didn't believe them because I had been taught otherwise from a young age. But 30 years later, we have this horrendous opioid epidemic that are killing thousands of people. You know, these are not small numbers. This is something I care tremendously about.
And there were a lot of lies that went on to get us to this place.
Oh, my God.
Holding those people accountable is important, too. Absolutely.
It is. And there's hope. There are paths to recovery. There is hope. People can get their lives back. They can get their kids back. They can get their jobs back. They can become good, functioning citizens and part of our community. And I feel like this is a medical issue. This is a healthcare issue. And one that I would really, really love to have an impact on.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody needs to. So, yeah, absolutely.
And finally, how can people get involved with your campaign?
Well, if people are interested in getting involved in the campaign, we would love to have them on board. The best way, I have an email. It's Karen for Kentucky, all spelled out. KarenForKentucky @gmail.com. You can email us. That way we have your email. Let us know what type of volunteer work you're interested in. We have need for people who want to make phone calls, need for people who want to go door knocking with me, people that are interested in writing postcards, people that are interested in organizing people that we have so much room for help. That anybody who wants to come on board, we would be thrilled to have them.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Karen Berg, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Well, guys, thank you so much for having me here. I've really appreciated it.
Thank you. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter @myoldkypod. We have a Facebook page that you can like, and you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. We also have a weekly newsletter that comes out on Fridays, which you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And last but not least, we have a Patreon page. You can support us for as little as $1 a month to support our creation, our hosting fees, and the work that we do. And that's at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
Yeah. This week on the newsletter, I'm writing about the fair. So if you want some hot fair takes, subscribe to the newsletter.
I can't wait.
All right. Everybody, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.